downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's Dr. Lisa, and it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I give a shit. How are you doing today? Good? You know what? I got myself, can I just tell you something? I got myself to do this hike tomorrow, and I even went and bought equipment, which is so out of, like, me in Paragon buying athletic equipment is a total joke. And I had it all worked out, and now it's going to fucking rain. Fucking thunderstorm tomorrow. So thank God I have such a great guest on today, Sherilyn Neidhart, because otherwise I'd be really depressed. So I can just put that aside and just focus on what I'm doing. So thanks a lot for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit on Radio Free Brooklyn. Did you know? So, like, I want to tell you something. We are really killing it with this teen after school program. We have the show called Teens Take the Mic, and now we have this whole program, and we got this like grant. So it's partially funded for our whole vision for all the teenagers. And we need to get you guys to help out, because bringing radio and teenagers together is really important, because if you don't, they will be in your neighborhood, you know, wrecking up your houses and cars and shit like that. So I think what's really important is that you help us fund it. No, it's really a good program, and I'm really proud of our station for, like, we're not getting paid to do this. We just do this, and I'm really proud of us. So go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/afterschool and donate money. Keep those kids off your lawn, mister. All right. So today is, I am really, really thrilled to have Sherilyn Neidhart on. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Sherilyn Neidhart. Say hi, Sherilyn.
Hello.
Do you trust what I'm going to say about you?
Should I?
No, definitely not. But I'm going to say it.
You're going to say it.
I'm going to say it. You're captive in the studio. You said you do the show. Unless you're going to run out right now, you got to listen to this, folks. Anyway, you know, the reason Sherilyn is on today is because she has a solo show opening at, I think, my favorite gallery, Art During the Occupation Gallery, which is out here in Bushwick. You know, next Friday night, the 7th, September 7th, you guys should come out here, because it's going to be like the craziest party ever. Just all the galleries are opening for their fall season. It's going to be wild. I mean, really, you're going to be reading about this with, like, FOMO, the worst FOMO you can imagine. You're going to be missing out if you don't fucking come to this. But the center of this, for me, is Sherilyn's solo show at Art During the Occupation Gallery, which is at 119 Ingraham Avenue, which is right off the Morgan L stop. The opening is from 6 to 9, okay? So I've told you about that now. You should come to it. The show's up till September 30th, and it's a really, really interesting show, and it's really evocative. So I'm going to tell you about Sherilyn and her art and the show, and then I'm going to get Sherilyn to tell you about her art, okay? No, she's just going to describe the show. I'm going to describe her. So Sherilyn is a somebody I've gotten to know since I've moved to Bushwick. I've gotten to know her maybe over the last 4 or 5 years. I don't even know. It feels like I've known her forever. And she is somebody that I'm going to say this. This is so cheesy, but it's true. I look up to you, Sherilyn. Did you know that? I fucking look up to you. And this is why. Because Sherilyn is really, really smart, really, really creative, and sensible in the perfect balance, which is very rare in this hood and then in this world. So she's, you know, like, if you want like a good answer or good, you know, Sherilyn's got her shit together, man. And these paintings, which you can see, you should see live, but you can also see them on her website, like I did, so I could at least talk about the show. And that's SharilynArt.com, SharilynArt.com. And her paintings are, they're like double exposures. She, the show is called Supermassive Black Hole. And the idea is that it's a feeling. Okay. The paintings are amazing because there are these beautiful, luscious and sort of a dark party, I think is a good way to put it. Like that party where everybody's like dancing and there's just something not, you know, some bad's going down, but everybody's having a good time. You don't know. Somebody's fucking in the bedroom or maybe, you know, something like that. Or maybe in the middle of the room. I don't know. You know what I mean? You've been to like a, you know, and like a DIY space. They're kind of like that, except that the actual quality of the painting is like incredibly sophisticated. And the thing about Sherilyn is her ability to draw and paint and her drive to draw and paint. Because I studied illustration and I spent my entire life, or up until I finally gave up after I graduated college and realized I didn't have the skills that I wished I had that Sherilyn possesses, that is just this magical ability to draw and paint. And, you know, I could draw, okay, I studied illustration. I could make a visual. I could make things known. But Sherilyn really commands the paint in a very deliberate and original and evocative, and she's really in there. Like the paintings sing for real, and her exhibition is 8 very large paintings, and the literal idea I think is mostly about the end. She wrote she calls it end stage capitalism, and is that okay?
Yeah.
Human feelings in the age of late stage capitalism. And, you know, it's kind of like everybody's having a good time, but there's just something not quite right. And that's the feeling you get from the paintings that sort of permeates, that I'm sure will permeate the room. But mostly, I just want to emphasize how the quality of these paintings, the communication of the feeling and the way they are painted is just incredibly, incredibly masterful. And I can't emphasize that enough without sounding cheesier than I do already. So, Sherilyn, what I want you to do is try and describe the show a little bit in your own words, because we already made a solid point about the actual work. So can you tell us what the meaning or the feeling of the show that you had in mind, that you have in mind?
Well, yeah, it is hard to talk about paintings on the radio, but I think I can say they're extremely colorful, and I am trying to, with the double, I work from double exposure photographs that I take myself, and with that, I'm trying to give kind of a cinematic feeling of movement to the paintings as well, so that they can live and not just be dead images on a wall. I want them to evoke a feeling of movement and a feeling of motion, because that's how I feel about the city that we live in and the world around us. Something is happening. Something is in motion beneath the surface that I think we're all aware of, and we're just not quite sure what it is.
So perfectly put. I struggled with that for half the show now. I should have just shut up. Anyway, and I love the titles. One of them is really dark, so I thought maybe you could just describe. This is actually the one I picked out to describe, but it's actually the one on the card. The title is called Licking Your Wounds to Get Blood on My Teeth. So what does that title evoke, or what made you use? That's dark. See what I mean? What are you trying to tell us here?
So all of the painting titles and also the title of the show are from song lyrics, because I, as we discussed before, I'm a little bit OCD and I get song lyrics stuck in my head all the time. So I'll usually name a painting after the song that I was obsessed with while I was making the painting. Mm-hmm. Lick Your Wounds to Get Blood on My Teeth is from a Matthew Dear song called mm-hmm. Ahead of Myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I will lick your wounds to get blood on my teeth.
Mm. Well, that's dark, isn't it?
And then the next thing he says is, but wait, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah.
I'm going to be releasing a playlist on iTunes and Spotify before the show with these songs and also other songs I listened to while I was creating the paintings. We'll also be playing the playlist at the opening party on the 7th.
Oh, that's fabulous. See, I told you it's going to be a good party.
It's going to be a rad party. There will be cupcakes.
And cupcakes. So I want to dive deeper into Sherilyn, but we also want to make sure that we talk about this other project that she's very deeply involved in called Transcender, which is a really valuable and community project that Christopher Stout of Art During the Occupation started, which why don't you tell us about it?
Sure, I'd be more than happy to. It's something that's really changed my life, honestly. Transcender is an art community, and we get together once a month. And for our monthly meetings, which are usually the last Tuesday of the month at Brooklyn Fireproof at 119 Ingram. For our meetings, usually a half dozen artists have about 10 minutes to show 10 slides of their work and talk about it. Mm-hmm. It's a really simple format. And I run this with two other people, Mir Musa and Tim Gowan. We take turns curating the night. So I think my next one is going to be in November. I'll bring in six artists.
And when is the next show, though? Or the
September,
next?
It's going to be September 25th.
Okay, it's not
it's
really.
It's going to be Mir's.
It's at the same space, 119 Ingraham Street, or not this. You know, same building. And it's just a really great community way for all the artists in the neighborhood to come together and review each other's work and get ideas and stimulate it and, you know, make connections and see their friends every month. And it's, you know, every artist community should do this because it really has made Bushwick a really special place just because this has been going on for years where people all get together once a month and know that they have a place to go. So I'm going to just say Sherilyn's a big part of that. And it's not all about her. You know, she gives a lot. She gives a lot back. So when I was doing my research on Sherilyn here, I thought I knew her pretty well, but I had to do some more research. And I found she had actually sent me a link, and I recommend it to you. It's a thought piece that she wrote called Why I Draw, and it's on drawing New York. And it was really meaningful to me because she really talks about the role that drawing has in her life. And I haven't, you know, knowing her the way I do, I sense that because I see that she is in drawing, you know, goes to life drawing all the time, like, you know, several times a week, which is a big deal for somebody with a job as a photo editor for a nice publication. So she does that all the time. And which she wrote about it in a way that it really fulfills an emotional need in her. And one of the things, here's the quote that I took out. Drawing takes so much of my concentration that it cleanses my mind of all other worries. I lose myself in the lines. And then she even spoke about it as an addiction. So one of the things that we talked about before we were on the air is that Sherilyn is sober. I knew that. Sherilyn is sober. And just how magical and fabulous and just what inspiration is, because she has actually taken the journey from sobriety and taken it into her art. And I thought I'll just ask her about that shit, because that's really
okay, cool.
That's really dark, just like her work. You know what I mean? This is dark shit. She's an alcoholic.
It's true.
In recovery. You're in fucking recovery. Doesn't that sound ridiculous though? I mean, I know it's serious shit and we shouldn't be making fun of it, but you're about as recovered as you're more recovered than anybody I know. So,
well, one thing that I have learned in sobriety is that AA is full of cliches and every single one of them is true. And what, you know, it's one day at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be clear of my addiction to alcohol. It's something that I have to deal with every single day.
So we were talking about a little, and it sounds like it's kind of genetic. Do you want to tell us like how it started?
Sure. I mean, alcohol was such a fact of my life. Even just was the background, because I started drinking probably age 17 when I went to college. And I do remember that kind of aha moment of getting drunk for the first time and thinking like, wow, awesome. This pretty much spells out my life path. This is the solution to all problems.
So was it like the first time you had your first drink, you got drunk?
No, not at all.
What happened?
I was blessed with a very high tolerance for alcohol.
Oh, so you felt drunk, but you didn't drink a lot.
No, it's more like the first couple of times I drank, I didn't drink enough to get drunk because my liver can process a lot of alcohol.
So that's when you started. And then did you drink a lot in college then?
I drank a lot in college. And I think, I mean, obviously, this is just my perspective, which mm-hmm. is necessarily compromised. But I think I was a pretty functional alcoholic. I never lost a job because of alcohol. I'm sure I strained many relationships mm-hmm. because of it. But, you know, I was in a place where I could function.
Were you a day drink? Did you start in the morning?
No, not so much, but definitely drank every day.
Right, but mostly after work?
Yeah, probably. I usually made myself wait until 5 p.m.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're pretty highly functional
and
self-protective.
Yeah. Yeah. But and I was protective of my drinking. I made sure that the structures were set up so that I could continue drinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it was, I think it sounds a lot like it was genetic in a way.
Sure. There's tons of alcoholism and drug addiction in my family. For sure.
Yeah, that's
my dad's sober. He was really influential on me and also really helped me in early sobriety.
Uh-huh. So you were able to tell them?
Yeah. Some of the talks I had with my dad my first year of sobriety were like kind of mind-blowing.
Really?
Yeah.
Like what did?
Just because he's been sober for like 40 years. And I feel like he was a high school teacher. I feel like he's just kind of seen it all.
Mm-hmm. So did he understand? He understood what you were going through?
Yeah, he had encouraged me to look at my drinking previously, and I just wasn't in a place where I could do it. And then all of a sudden, I really was.
So what happened?
I was kind of having some health problems, and I went, like, they seemed minor to me, but I went and had a blood panel done, and the doctor told me, your liver is failing, and if you keep drinking, your liver will fail. They won't give you a new liver because you're an alcoholic. So you need to stop drinking.
Wow.
And I think the doctor kind of suggested to me like maybe cut back. But I knew that I couldn't cut back.
Yeah.
I knew I needed to stop. So I tried. I set a goal to stop drinking for 30 days. And at the end of that 30 days, I felt so amazing.
Really?
I was in a kind of ecstasy.
Really?
Yes. I was like, oh God, why did no one tell me how awesome it is to stop drinking?
You felt great.
Yeah. I was very sick for like the first 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then once I got past that, I felt physically amazing.
I can imagine.
All of the anxiety and terror started coming in for me too. But physically, I knew it was the right decision. Like my body is just healthier. There's just no two ways about that.
Wow.
I had been stressing my body out with drinking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we especially the latest report, all alcohol is bad. That's no fun.
I know.
And then, so that, was it hard to, did you go to meetings, or had it, was it a lot of self-discipline, or?
Well, I mean, I think I'd like to think it was a lot of self-discipline. I'm not sure. I think it was more fear of dying.
Uh-huh.
Just because after that experience, the physical toll it was taking on me seemed so clear.
Ah, I see. Once you stopped drinking, you realized.
Yeah. And I think I did go to meetings in my first year.
Mm-hmm.
AA is not super great for me. I mm-hmm. still do go sometimes.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been sober?
I'm almost to my 5-year mark, and wow. I'm very excited about that.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
And you're in your 40s.
Yes, I'm 47.
And that's impressive. That's very... So, but the thing that's so interesting is that the way that you talked about art sort of taking over that need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people have remarked to me that I'm a very productive artist. I make a lot of work. And that's, I would say, 99% sobriety for me. I was a painter before, and I made art. I didn't start taking it as seriously until I got sober. About 6 months after I got sober, I started making art almost obsessively. I made art all the time.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? Tell us about that.
I would come home from work and just make little watercolor paintings that were like 6 by 6 inches. But I couldn't stop. It was all I thought about when I was at work. I was like, I just want to go home and make little watercolor paintings. They were like kind of Mondrian-esque, like just squares and rectangles.
Mm-hmm. Like kind of subconscious stuff.
Yeah, I just wanted to make marks. I just wanted to...
And just so we understand your background as an artist, I mean, you were one of those... Sherilyn is like so natural talented at drawing and stuff. So you were one of those kids who was really good all through school, right? But at drawing?
Yeah, I've always drawn.
But you didn't study that. You weren't serious about being an artist in college. Would you do study in college?
I studied international relations and then comparative literature.
Mm-hmm. And so you weren't thinking about being an artist?
No, I took a painting class in college and I hated it. I didn't like the assignments. I thought they were stupid. Mm. Well, they actually were stupid.
Probably.
And I took an art history class that I just found stultifying. And it's so funny because I actually love art history now. I think either that class
must
was being taught poorly
teacher.
Or I just wasn't into it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I was 19. What did I know?
Mm-hmm. So finding your way back to painting, like, were you painting? How much painting were you doing before you got sober? Like, what was your?
I had an easel set up in my house, and like, I'd make 12 or 14 paintings a year. But I mean, I can make that in a month now.
Wow!
I have a studio that's not far from here,
right.
And I paint if I'm not at home, like Netflixing while I fall asleep on the couch. I'm at my studio.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. That is fabulous. Have you seen your work grow by leaps and bounds?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the investment of time is a huge change for me. I mean, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talks about the 10,000 hours. And I think that's really been true for me. The more I apply myself, the more time I spend thinking about making visual art, the deeper it goes for me. It seems almost limitless.
Well, what's so cool about it is that, you know, I'm hearing now that, you know, this has only been a serious journey of like the last 5 years. And now you're having like this really major solo show with like these huge, how big are the paintings? They're huge.
They're quite large. They're as large as I could make in my studio. The largest one is 8 feet across.
Okay. Yeah. So you have 8 of those, which you've made in like a year or less, or...
It's been about a year and a half that I've been working on this series. Mm-hmm. Yeah, since last June.
Mm-hmm. Including all the other drawing classes and...
I mean, this is just one series. I have. Mm-hmm. I'm always working on a ton of projects because I'm kind of OCD.
Yeah. Yeah, you made a lot more work than this. That's what I'm saying. I know you have.
I'm working on a series of drawings based on people I see in the subway. They're mm-hmm. on pieces of aluminum composite that I salvaged from Ingram Street, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They're cut to look like, they're actually signs. Like they were going to be stop signs or yield signs, but they screwed up or something. I don't know. I found 20 of them on the street. So I'm painting onto those aluminum sheets pictures of people on the subway.
Oh, wow. Oh, that sounds really neat. And I also, you know, I remember when I first saw your work, I think it was around the first time, I was really drawn to the paintings you were making about cops or something.
Oh, yeah.
What was that about again?
So I did a previous series called I Love a Man in a Uniform. And as you can see, I use song lyrics a lot. That's a song by Gang of Four, I Love a Man in a Uniform. And each painting in that series is a lyric from the song.
Ah.
They're all based on photojournalism images that I got at work. And they're all cops dressed in, usually in riot gear, at the scenes of peaceful protests around America.
So they really illuminate how we're prepared for war, even with our citizens. Just like with our citizens.
Right? Yeah, that work was made in 2016 for the most part. And those pieces, like there was a lot of civil unrest at that time. In my job as a photo editor, I'm often going through looking at pictures that are coming in from across the country and around the world from the wire services. And this was a theme that I noticed, that the cops that were at peaceful protests were extremely heavily armed, sometimes even with military equipment, which definitely seems like overkill to me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. Trump loves that shit. So anyway, let's do a station ID. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay. So, and I just want to say thanks again for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm here with my guest, Sherilyn Neidhart, who's having a solo exhibition at Art During the Occupation Gallery. So we're talking about her relationship with her work, stuff like that. And the title of her show is Supermassive Black Hole, and it's going to be opening September 7th at Art During the Occupation Gallery, which is 119 Ingram Street, which is at the L. Morgan stop, and it's going to be a fucking amazing party. And also, Bushwick is the place to be that night because there's like all the openings in the beginning of the season. And then I also want to remind you that we're doing this really great show with my good friend, host Ben. Ben Talks Live. Ben is a really popular host at the station, and we're doing he's doing a live show, and it's September 10th coming up at 9 p.m. at the Pine Box Rock Shop at 12 Grattan Street. In Brooklyn, same stop, L train to Morgan. And so you should come to that, but don't forget about the 7th. You're gonna be hearing a lot about this because there's so much going on. I'm sure you'll be getting emails. You'll be getting harassed about it for sure. So how does it feel now that you have this show coming up? Like, does that kind of fit into like the storyline of like going from, you know, your begin, like it's interesting hearing about you talking about coming home and making those abstract watercolors and now, so how does this feel for you when you look at it from that point of view?
Yeah, I feel like this body of work is much like, at least in contrast to say The Cops, or I did another series that were about bullet holes at the scenes of mass shootings. Those were the images I used for those processes were more rooted in photojournalism. The images that I used as a jumping off place for Supermassive Black Hole are photos I took myself.
Right. And that's a really big difference because it's sort of like the initial images were influenced by images you were seeing at work. And these images, the inspiration for these seemed to be constructed more from your own life.
Yes.
Does it feel like that?
Are we
getting a call?
I think you are getting a call.
Okay, let's see. Hello?
Oh, hi. My name's Alan. Hi.
Hi, Alan. Are you calling because you want to win the book?
Yes.
Oh.
Where are you going? I've tried to stream the radio station. I had problems, and I thought I'd call direct since I had the number. Just really, I'm out of town, so.
Oh yeah.
I didn't even know I'd get even
okay,
the phone.
Okay, so you know what? I'm gonna get your address because this was a little awkward for me. We had Spencer and Kristen on last week, and Spencer Tunick and Kristen Bowler. They do amazing, amazing work, and
That's how I found out about you.
I know, and I'm telling my listeners to go look at their work at SpencerTunick.com. And Spencer was so generous that he gave us a book that he signed, and he said we should give it away to the first caller. And so now that's you, and I'm going to get your name and address, and I'm going to send you the book. Thanks for calling. What's your name?
That's a miracle, I say.
I wish I had my producer to do all this, but look at this. This is a nonprofit radio station, and we have to interrupt our intense interview for this, but go ahead.
Okay. My name's Alan, A-L-A-N. Last name, Lane, L-A-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
Lane, and my address is 200-88
Mm-hmm.
Tappan Z, like the bridge. Tappan, T-A-P-P-A-N.
T-E-E. T-A-P-P?
Yeah, T-A-P-P.
At Tappan Z, what?
Yeah. Drive.
Drive.
Yes, I'm in Port, C-O-R-T, Port Charlotte, as in like the woman Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
C-H-A-R.
Mm-hmm. Dot.
I mean, R. L-O-T-E, yeah, and Florida, 33952.
33952?
Yes.
Okay, Alan, we're going to get this book off to you. Tell all your, make sure that you listen to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit every Thursday, 2 to 3. Make your friends do it and call back next week and tell me if you got the book, okay?
Sorry, there's a thunderstorm and dog bark. Yeah, so 20088. Tappan Z Drive in Port Charlotte.
200-88952,
right?
Yep.
In Florida. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Alan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, we did that. We gave a book away.
Congratulations. Congratulations, Alan.
That book's going to Florida.
That's amazing.
Well, we made somebody happy.
Yay!
Now back to the paint. Now back to, like, the story of your life.
Oh, right. Oh, that.
So anyway, I found it. So we were talking about how I think it's really interesting that it seems like the earlier work that you did was influenced by the visuals that you were, let's say, confronted with. You see like hundreds, thousands of photos a day.
Sometimes, yeah.
And they're all newsworthy.
Yeah, I'm usually looking at a feed of images that are being filed by photographers who are out in the field. So it's pretty immediate within mm-hmm. the last couple hours.
Right. So, and that's obvious an interest of yours. And I know personally you're very politically astute and stuff like that. So it seems like you might have taken some of that sensibility about like how the pictures make you feel about what's happening out in the world and then just transferred that onto your own experience when you're out in the world.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so you're noticing your world. So all that drawing, and one of the things that you talked about in your in the article you wrote is about how I got distracted by, oh my God, there's too much going on. Rob distracted me. So anyway, it just sounds like there was so much going on, like, you know, like the feeling, there is a certain, like, reality that you bring to the imagery of what's really going on behind the actual photo, and it seems like you've sort of taken that feeling and brought it. And you were talking about in that article how you were really noticing how when you draw, you really see everything more clearly. Is that right?
Yeah. I've had this experience that I was struggling to describe, and I think a lot of people who draw will say they feel it too. After you've been looking at a model for a couple of hours and mm-hmm. trying to break down the shapes of a person in a room in a real world, you're trying to use your brain to make that into lines and shapes. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard project. And for me, it's so hard that I actually can't think about anything else when I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. It crowds out like stuff I'm worried about, friends I'm worried about, like, mm-hmm. do I have money? Did I remember to pay that bill? Like, I can't think about any of those things mm-hmm. because drawing is a hard project for my brain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then when I release that pressure at the end of the session and I walk outside, the world looks different. Mm. It looks physically different to me. I'm like, oh, there's that triangle. Oh, I see how that shadow is falling across the car. Like, isn't that interesting? Oh, look, I see how the light from the subway station is making a soft shadow on the sidewalk. Isn't that interesting? And the world, like, I want to say it kind of flattens out, but it's not a dampening. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. it's like the world is more like open to me now.
Mm-hmm. So it's an actual perception. It's yes. just a physical. Well, you know, it's a perception.
It's almost like doing drugs.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So
it's almost like an acid flashback, which those are fun.
Yeah. No. It sounds. It sounds. Well, it sounds like you really. It really does have to do with what your brain has been doing.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it gets into a mode that's very, you know, cognitive or whatever. It just doesn't turn off that way. You kind of get into it, and then I guess you have to get out of it, or, you know, transition into it, transition out of it. Just like a lot of physical, just like fucking yoga, folks. You know what yoga is. It sounds just like yoga, except you wind up with a painting instead of a sore back.
You might not be doing yoga right.
I'm not doing any fucking yoga. You kidding? I'm too cynical for that. So speaking of cynical and stuff, so how about let's talk about the dark feelings, because they're coming out in your work, sure. right?
So, yeah, I mean, I think so.
which is what makes them sort of attractive, because they're not, it makes, it's, the feelings are there and it makes them interesting. I mean, unless you like, you know, still live. It, for me, I mean, there are people who like really nice, pretty paintings and stuff like that. And they just want to be, see everything nice and sound of music like. And so, but are those dark feelings, is there stuff that haunts you? Like artists, like art, like the typical, like a cliche artist?
Well, I don't know if I would say there's things that haunt me, but I will say I think that you can't work in newsrooms for a long time without being somewhat cynical, mm-hmm. Because you tend to see a lot of the really gross and bad side of humanity when you work in a newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the people in the newsroom, obviously, but mm-hmm. just because the news can be very depressing.
Mm.
People do terrible things to each other.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I've mostly worked at tabloid type newspapers. I worked at the New York Post for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think humans have a natural cognitive bias towards bad news, actually, because bad news is more important mm-hmm. for your brain. Right. Like, you need to be aware of bad news.
Right.
Good news is kind of icing on the cake.
Yeah, right.
Bad news has much more urgency for our brains. So a lot of tabloid news is bad news.
Is there a lot of stuff that most people don't get to see?
I think the things that get edited out have to do with explicit expressions of death and dismemberment.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen a lot of that?
Photographically, yes.
So does that affect you?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes more than others. I think I do have a bit of a hard shell around myself, but mm-hmm. sometimes things get through. I was very affected by the massacre in Las Vegas.
Mm.
I was working the night that happened, and I ended up staying on until 6 a.m.
Mm.
to help guide the coverage. And we were seeing a lot of pictures of dead people before the slot editors started editing it out and like making sure.
What editors? I'm sorry.
So there are editors between the photographers and the newswire.
Slot editors?
Mm-hmm.
Are those the people like at Facebook but that look at the sites and take them down?
No, horrible. No, it's very technical. But what my point was, we were seeing a lot of pictures of death and dismemberment, and there was the, I mean, 600 people were shot that night.
No, it's like
it was in just unimaginable, and we were looking at a lot of videos of people panicking, people who were seriously wounded, and that really stayed with me. That was a really horrible one.
Do you guys talk about that? I mean, does it affect everybody?
It does, and we do talk about it a lot, actually. It can be difficult to work on breaking news. It affects people psychologically, for sure.
Yes,
but it's important work.
It's important.
Something I believe in.
Right. It's real journalism. I mean, that's what journalism, that's what real journalism is. That kind of stuff, getting stuff out that people need to see. That's difficult, but also presenting it in a way that communicates.
Yeah, and I personally believe my feelings about gun rights are known to anyone who will ask me. I feel strongly that we need better gun control in our country. And that I think that's a shining example of why. Like, it's so deadly, and it can hit anywhere, and it can hit anyone. And it would be relatively easy for us to do something about that politically.
So I guess what I'm wondering about is that dark area, and I certainly have that, we all have that, or most of us have some of it, is like that dark buzz that we all have in us. Is that, has that, so I'm thinking in terms of sort of trading drinking for art, making art. So did it, so you were, there's always some of that when you're drinking, right? Sometimes. And then there's always, has it made it better? Has it made it less? Or is it just a different way of coping with it?
I think it's more that it's a different way of coping with it. I think just the way that my brain is wired, I'm a person that experiences a lot of natural free-floating anxiety. And drinking was a way of coping with that. Unfortunately, that was also a way that was causing me a lot of physical harm. Getting into artistic expression is a very different way of coping with that. I think it's in some ways a less complete solution.
Really?
In that I've still needed to deal with a lot of social anxiety.
You have social anxiety?
So much social anxiety.
What are you talking about? Seem like you do. You're like you're somebody that everybody really, you know, gravitates to and respects.
Then I must be coping with it very effectively.
You're fucking hiding it. You're fucking hiding it, girl.
Well, that's what alcoholics do.
Yeah, so you're just now. Have you always been like that? Like,
I was painfully shy as a child. Like, I wouldn't even talk to people. I mean, look, other humans can be very dangerous.
That's
and
true.
Scary, and their feelings are uncontrollable.
Yes.
Like, damn, other humans.
They're horrible.
They're wacky.
Other humans are fucked up. So in a way, the endeavors that you're doing, like the Transcender thing and the art, you know, the drawing, they're not classes, sessions, whatever you call them, is a way of being social without having to actually just be there to socialize.
Yeah, I think also I would take it even a step further and say that my natural inclination is to isolate and be by myself, because that's such an easier problem to deal with, just my own anxiety.
I
don't think that's super healthy for me. Transcender has been an incredible godsend in that regard, to connect with other artists in a lightly social setting, to see what they're working on, to see the problems that they're solving, to see how they're dealing with their being in the world and just encountering everyday life. I can't even tell you how uplifting that is for me. I look forward to Transcender every single month.
No, it's wonderful. And you guys are really great about managing it and getting the word out and getting such great artists. I mean, it's a really great community experience, which is so cool.
It blows me away every time. You know, when we took it over from Christopher Stout, and Christopher was running the Bushwick Art Critique Group, which drew like 100 people sometimes. It was very popular.
I don't know. This is still popular, but go ahead. Look, if I do a show, I'm glad if I get 6 people. So I'm always very, very impressed.
When we started Transcender, we were like, well, you know, the artists will have to come, so that'll be 6 people. And so we sometimes have standing room only now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The ones I've been to.
It just blows me away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's so easy to think in our modern world that we're just isolated in our little mm-hmm. bubble and we're the only ones who are dealing with it. But in fact,
yeah,
there are people just like us.
I know. It's crazy. I know. You know, I am actually like, I have a lot of social anxiety myself. Can you tell that about me?
I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised? Yes, you can.
I can tell.
You can tell how socially anxious I am, right?
I think I can because I see you as using performance as a way to overcome that.
Really? Even like out in the world? You think I'm performing all the time?
I think you're performing a lot of the time.
Ah, I've heard that too. I've heard that too. I think you're right about that. Yeah, I got to deal with, I believe you me, I think you're right about that. But I also wind up in there's so many, you know, socializing is different than a one-on-one thing.
For sure.
It?
Oh, absolutely.
And throughout most of my life until like the last 5-10 years, that was really most of my life. Being alone or one-on-one. And so I think I am not comfortable with all the socializing that people, that I do, that my husband documents. So it's weird. People think I'm really social.
You know, when I was newly sober, I always have gone to a lot of art openings, but doing it sober for the first few times was so hard for me.
Oh, man.
And I would make myself a deal. Like, I'm going to talk to 3 people and then I'm going to leave. And I had to complete that. And of course, I'm OCD, so I had to complete it. But I would very carefully pick out 3 people I'm going to exchange words with and then I'm going to leave because it was too hard otherwise. I didn't know anybody. I had so much trouble making connections. I was so happy to find Christopher's group. I'm so happy to see people from Transcender out at openings now. Mm-hmm. Now that process is so much easier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, it's so common that people feel this way and we all sort of keep it to ourselves thinking everybody else is just, you know, swimming along.
Well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
To be neurotic?
Well, if you are socially isolated, it's natural to think no one shares in my pain, in my experience, because you're socially isolating yourself.
Well, yeah, but it's also like I can't deal with other people, so I won't go out, or I'll go out by myself, which is really more common. And then you wind up perpetuating it because you're always alone.
Exactly.
So have you spent long periods alone or?
Yeah, I think I'm fairly comfortable being alone. Like, mm-hmm. I actually love going to the movies by myself.
Yeah, me too.
It's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I hear you.
And of course, I spend hours by myself in my studio, which is very comfortable for me. I love it. Sometimes I'm like, I can't believe I have to go do something because I just want to stay in my studio.
Yeah, I bet.
But I also work in a very social environment. A newsroom doesn't have, most of them anyway, don't have partitions or dividers. We work all at one long table. We're constantly interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I think that's probably a good way. But being, you know, it's funny. Like, there's a way of being social and then there's a way of being productive with other people.
True.
Which is always to me feels so much more rewarding, right? Or whatever. That doesn't make me nervous if I know we have something we have to get done together.
Shared goals are extremely powerful.
That's what we need, folks. Shared goals. More shared goals. So we've got a few minutes left. I want to make sure that we get all your feelings about the show coming up. So sure. How is it? So we were saying that you know, it's pretty awesome if you look back, because 5 years is not a very long time to be looking back on, like, going, like, you have this big solo show coming up. So there must be a, like, I'm like, wow, that's a big achievement.
Thank you very much.
Because most people, you know, we all take like 20 years to get to that or something like that, you know. So are you feeling like, yeah, or?
It feels like a big accomplishment to me. I'm very excited to share this work. Mm-hmm. It feels very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to take the stage.
Mm-hmm. And what about like your family, like, and other people that have known you for a long time? Like, what kind of comments or like, what kind of feedback have you gotten so far?
It's been widely supportive.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a lot of people in my corner who are invested in my success.
Doesn't it feel a little bit like a wedding somehow or something like that?
Kind
Does it feel
of, yeah.
like that?
It's weird. I had like this very intense dream about getting married last night. I think
you
it
did.
Does have that cast to it. Like, it is a big life event for me, like, mm-hmm. of that magnitude. Mm-hmm. It's something I've been preparing for a
forever.
Year and a half now.
Well,
yeah.
forever, really.
Forever.
Yeah. And I do think it is a momentous, but that's a funny thing about having a show like this, I think, is that it's about the work, but it's also a real milestone.
It is for me, for sure.
And I think that it's really important to remember that, or allow, like, you know, I don't know how you feel. Sometimes I feel like if I have something big coming up, I feel like I get nervous, you know, like, oh, it's so big. Oh, it's not that big. Oh, it's so big. But
well,
it's better just to own it.
I think it's really important to note here that it's not something I'm doing alone at all. I have a huge team of people supporting me, mm-hmm. emotionally. Christopher Stout, who really believed
yes.
in my work and held my hand through this.
Yeah.
Like, you and I are friends. You've been super supportive of my work. Simon Levinson at Drawing New York, whose drawing sessions I go to, who published my work on his site. I mean, so many people have reached out to me and helped me. I feel like so supported by my community.
That's so great.
It's incredible, actually. You know, like, Sibeli Vieira, she is the one who encouraged me at the very beginning. She used to be my studio mate. She's the one who brought me
right.
into Brooklyn Fireproof. She really believed in me, too. Like, there are so many people who
Sibeli's just so great that way.
Gave me a hand and were like, you can do it.
Wow. Wow. Is anybody from your job coming?
Oh, probably. I hope
are,
so.
Are
Shout
they,
out to the Daily Mail photo desk.
Is the Daily Mail photo desk aware of all this?
Oh, yes. They
very
certainly
aware.
Are. Yes. For sure. Actually, Alyssa Hargrove, who I work with, actually just shot pictures of me that you can see on my website. She came to my studio.
Oh, wow. Oh, neat. Neat. Maybe we'll put one of those up.
Sure.
Yeah. And what are you wearing? Can we ask that?
Oh, yeah. So I have a friend who's working on a costume for me, and I'm actually not going to describe it too much because
okay.
it's going to be a surprise.
Oh, wow. So you're having like a special thing made.
Oh, it's we're going all
you.
Out. We're going all out.
See, this is why I did not want to get married, because the whole wedding thing to me is so stupid when you put it in terms of like it makes it's like an achievement. You hooked a guy. Whereas when you have a show like the one you're having, that's a genuine achievement. That's a life marker in a journey through life and a journey through your art, which art transcends all artists and all of us and time and history and everything. It's just one big, big bucket that we're all just pouring ourselves into, right? Throughout
yeah.
throughout humanity.
Sure.
And to have a milestone in that bucket is just huge. And to me, and I think probably this is what we're talking about, is that with, you know, that is a real profound, I think it's really profound milestone. I mean, you know, I know there'll be like some guy who got off at the wrong subway stop and wanders in and doesn't know where the fuck he is and what is this painting, what are these, what's this, but on a personal level, I think for you the artist, there is something really meaning very meaningful, or, you know, life affirming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting because God may she rest in peace, Annie Herron, who is was a wonderful, wonderful Williamsburg curator. Her words that always ring in my head is, well, she said, real artists are like monks to me. But she also said that when you show the work, it changes the work.
Yeah, it does.
And I always find that really, really interesting.
The crazy thing to me is I've participated in Bushwick Open Studios for the last few years, and I'm constantly having people come into my studio and explain my work to me. I'm not saying that's negative. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, 'cause I don't always understand what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone I don't know to come into my studio and be like, oh, I see what you did here. It's this. That's a gift. That's mm-hmm. incredible.
Well, it kind of completes the cycle of making the work and getting the response and like having it go through somebody else back to you.
That's what tells me that the work is communicating effectively.
Right. You know, I also want you guys to know this about Sherilyn, that I want to make sure we don't gloss over this, but Sherilyn is also more than any artist that I know personally that I'm aware of is into making her own paints and her own materials. And I mean, I find that incredible, like another deeper level of relating to the work. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I used to run a small art supply store on Bedford Avenue called Sarcana Art Materials. And we made all the paint by hand. Well, most of it. We didn't make the titanium white. But yeah, we ground it out by hand in a very old-fashioned process. And I really learned to have an appreciation for what goes into art materials. And although I don't run that business anymore, and mm-hmm. I haven't for many years,
mm-hmm.
I still sometimes make paint with my friends. I've gone to Kremer Pigments and made paint there.
Mm-hmm.
I am very sensitive to the materials, and it's mm-hmm. something I love to talk about. So if you come to the opening and you have art materials questions, feel free to hit me up.
Yeah, you're a real nerd about that.
Super nerdy.
So does it feel different when you've made your own paint?
Oh, yeah. One of the last pieces I made for Supermassive Black Hole, I did the whole underpainting with this ultramarine blue that I made with my friend Jacob. And it has some marble dust in it. And it's just the quality of it. It's so beautiful. And it's so intensely blue. Like, it's really the bluest thing I've ever seen.
So when you look at other paintings, when you go to an exhibit, like, let's say an art fair or museum, whatever, can you tell a lot about the quality of the paint?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and
it's something I think about and look at, for sure.
Can you tell, like, a higher end, like a more well-known artist uses better paint, or can you tell if they do or they don't, or...
Sometimes, but it's more, I'm often looking at an older work if it's falling apart.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I see. It's the right, whether it lasts.
If you're an art materials nerd, that's something you obsess on.
Okay, we have 1 minute left, and I have to say goodbye. So say your three big influences, famous artists. Can you come up with that?
Yeah, Robert Rauschenberg, James Rosenquist. I'm going to say Georgia O'Keeffe as well.
All right. That's excellent. So come to the show. The opening is next Friday. What am I saying?
Friday, September 7th.
Why did I say that?
6 p.m. to 9 p.m. 119 Ingram.
Art during the Occupation Gallery. The name of the show is Submissive Black Hole by Sherilyn Neidhart.
Supermassive Black Hole.
Supermassive Black Hole. And I have all the information on my Facebook page, so you can go to that. And also, I want...